Rising Giants Network.
The first half of the 90s was an absolutely insane time to be in Metallica. They toured and toured and toured. They had a Grammy win, and they became a household name. But Metallica, at the end of 1994, had to take a step back to figure out their next move. The Black Album era was coming to a close, but as that era came to a close, so did in many ways the mainstream stature of heavy metal. With post-grunge bands, alt-rock, and the new underground scene known as nu metal making strides, Metallica had to consider how to remain relevant and how to challenge their creativity in an ever-changing world. During this time, the band would take a sharp turn and somewhat unrecognizable path. And just like many bands before them, as they grew more popular, the egos got bigger. Creative differences, image changes, and personality crashes would plague this next chapter in the Metallica story. From the Rising Giants Network, I am Basil, and this is Legendary Rock Stories Season 1, the story of heavy metal titans, Metallica. This is Episode 4, The Road to Self-Destruction. It's November 1995. Lars was driving back from a dinner party. On the radio was the band U2's latest single, Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me, from the soundtrack of the latest Batman movie, Batman Forever. Lars cranked up the song and drowned out any thought he may have had at the moment. U2 excited Lars. He loved how big the band were and how many times they've managed to reinvent themselves. He loved their experimentation and their guts to go places their fans never expected of them. Lars shared this passion with Metallica's guitarist Kirk Hammett. In the mid-90s, both Lars and Kirk would start to get into bands like U2, REM, and even Oasis, some of the biggest bands at the time. They started seeing Metallica in a different light. Both Lars and Kirk also started getting into abstract art. Their influences have really changed since the earlier days of Metallica, and this prompted them to look inwards and think about what kind of future they wanted for the band. On a Tuesday afternoon in late 1995, Lars and Kirk have been talking about a new direction for months. Now they needed to make the pitch to James Hetfield, Jason Newsted, and Bob Rock. So over a lunch filled with sandwiches and French fries, Lars lays out the approach and the overall mindset that him and Kirk had been talking about for a while.
Guys, you look out there and heavy metal isn't what it used to be. Now you have huge bands like U2, REM, and even Metallica. Bands are just bands. Some are heavier, some are softer. But heavy metal or even pop is just one big f***ing soup now. There are no genres anymore.
You see, in Lars's view, the music scene had substantially changed when grunge legends Nirvana took over the world of mainstream. There were no longer any prevalent defined genres. Everything became blurry. Bands are just good or bad. Genres didn't really matter. That was his view. So Kirk Hammett continued, "Yeah, we need Metallica to move into a different image direction. We need to reinvent ourselves." James Hetfield and Jason Newsted were a little taken aback by what this approach sounds like. Abstract? Art? U2? Yikes, this does not sound metal at all. Putting the image question aside for a second, both James and Lars were already hard at work at the band's latest effort, their sixth album, Load. The approach to the actual writing process of Load wasn't very different to past records. Lars and James would drive the structure of the album, and the guys would come in later. James Hetfield thought that writing traditional and fast heavy metal songs had become boring and wasn't challenging him to be creative. In fact, no one in Metallica was interested in writing another thrash metal album. The guys wanted to write something different and surprise both themselves and their fans. So they slowed down their jams, tried various chord structures, and ditched the speed and pounding drums. The goal was to find their new voice and stimulate themselves creatively. Kirk Hammett would tell the guys, "Guys, we've already proven to the world that we can play heavy. We can play fast. But for the next record, let's save some precious CD space for things that we haven't done before. Something fresh, as long as it's creative and challenging." This new self-induced challenge prompted the guys to write 27 songs, incorporating elements of blues, country, and southern rock. A brand new sound was shaping up for Metallica. Some of the songs from the new collection were typical Metallica hard hitters. Songs like Ain't My Bitch, House That Jack Built, and King Nothing still had strong heavy metal vibes. But bigger risks like Mama Said and Ronnie were huge departures from regular Metallica fury. Lyrically, James Hetfield took a more personal approach to these songs, which was another detour from the usual social commentary the band were known for in their first four albums. Bob Rock was at the production helm, and once again, he pushed the guys to polish and structure the songs in the best way possible. This was a completely new direction for everyone involved. Rock would question the guys on lyrics, parts, he would tell them to replay them, and even restructure the songs. The guys trusted and respected him, and he was involved from the beginning. At this point, it's been over 5 years since Metallica's last album release. Anticipation and excitement mounted from the fans. To some degree, everyone expected Metallica to go back to their thrash roots. But let's just say, everyone was in for a surprise. On a warm day in early 1996, the boys talk about their plans for their next album. Cliff Bernstein and Peter Mensch of Q Prime Management meet with the boys.
"Whoa, boys, you wrote 27 songs. I mean, that's a lot. Are we thinking of releasing a double album here? Two CDs? Lars, Kirk, what do you guys think?"
"That would require a lot of work in the studio, Peter. I'm not sure that's the best idea."
"Yeah. Also, don't you think 27 songs is a lot of material for people to go over? It's a lot of material to digest. Maybe we should look at two separate albums."
James Hetfield likes that idea.
"Yeah, two separate albums would be the way to go here. We'll release them in two consecutive years. We'll call them Load and Reload."
The boys loved that idea, and so it was decided. Metallica would release not one, but two albums. 14 songs make it on Load, and the rest would be left for Reload. There would be no preference in selection of which songs made it to which album. The first 14 songs that made it to Load were simply the most worked on and the most developed. The rest would make it to Reload. Now, remember Lars and Kirk's vision for a new image? Well, that didn't focus on music only. It also focused on a new look for the band. So a series of actions took place that would completely transform the band's image. The most notable one, the guys cut their hair. Yes, they cut their hair. How can you be in a metal band and not have long hair to headbang? That was just unheard of. Well, Metallica chopped off that hair and went with a more classic short hair look. But that wasn't U2 enough for Kirk and Lars. The guys did a promo photo shoot, which saw them wearing stylish outfits and makeup. That's right, makeup. Something the younger Metallica would never go for. Dark nail polish and eyeliner made the band look unrecognizable from their former selves. Then came the album cover for Load. An artwork entitled Semen and Blood 3 is a piece produced by artist Andres Serrano by mixing together blood and his own semen between two sheets of plexiglass to produce what looked like, or what could be described as, lava. But it surely wasn't lava. The cover of Reload would follow the same style, except this time it would include piss and blood. Metallica would also ditch their famous logo in favor of a new and redesigned one. This was a completely new band from any way you would look at it. Music, image, cover, everything was different. Even their logo was different. This bugged James. James Hetfield was all about the music. He did not really like any of the new image ideas that were coming his way from Lars Ulrich and Kirk Hammett, but he saw that both Kirk and Lars were really passionate about this new way of working, so he went along with it. In the studio, as they looked at all the images from their photo shoots, along with new cover art ideas, James finally speaks up.
"Guys, I'm not sure about this. I don't want this photo, that one, or even this one. I don't want them to make it anywhere. Please get rid of them. In fact, these ones too. Oh, and that one."
Kirk snaps at James. "James, that's half the images, man. You gotta play ball."
James looks back at Kirk.
"Look, none of this is my idea. But if you guys feel strongly about this, I'm willing to try it out. If we all get into it, there might be a chance this works. So I'm handing it over to you guys. You drive this."
Even Jason Newsted wasn't on board with this whole image revamp thing. Neither was he loving the album direction. He didn't think any of these ideas sounded or looked like Metallica to him. He didn't think Metallica should be doing country music, for example. But hey, just like Hetfield, he went along with it. This departure wouldn't stop there. Metallica shot a video for the first single off the album, Until It Sleeps, which is a hard rock track which couldn't be any different from what fans expected. The video was based on an abstract art which depicts the paintings of an artist called Hieronymus Bosch. It was weird, it was surreal, and it was out of their comfort zone. But that's exactly what they wanted. So on May 21st, 1996, MTV played Until It Sleeps for the first time. And the fans, well, the fans got their first look on the new version of Metallica. Less than a month later, Load was released and went on to sell over 600,000 copies in its first week alone. The fans and critics received the album to mixed reviews. Many media publications admired Metallica's courage to reinvent themselves, but also really enjoyed these songs. Rolling Stones magazine, Q magazine, and LA Times gave the album rave reviews. The fans, however, couldn't have been more divided. Metallica were accused of selling out their most loyal fans, leaving behind the genre that propelled the band to greatness. This was not Metallica. This was a hard rock band pretending to be the band that they loved. Load did, however, bring in a new generation of fans to Metallica, which was, I guess, a good thing. Songs like King Nothing and Ain't My Bitch became metal anthems to this new generation of fans discovering Metallica for the first time. Metallica would go on tour with this new image and armed with new songs. The band would still play to sold-out stadiums around the world. They even adopted a rebellious attitude in the industry in order to complement this new direction they were going in. In one instance, the band was invited to play at the MTV Music Awards. They were slated to play their new single, King Nothing. But at that very last minute, Metallica decided to go live on air and play the profanity-filled song, So What? Live on air, without any prior notice to MTV. This got the MTV personnel scrambling to cut the feed and censor the band. But it was too late. Millions of people saw James Hetfield drop the F-bomb a dozen times in 4 minutes. When the show later aired as a rerun, Metallica were completely cut out and completely edited out of the show. A little over a year later, Metallica completed work on the second batch of songs from the Load sessions and released Reload in November 1997. The album sold 450,000 copies in its first few days of release. The Memory Remains was the first song off the album to make it on MTV. The reception of Reload was similar to Load. Fans doubled down on the accusations of the band selling out, Some fans even called Metallica old and couldn't even play the old songs even if they wanted to. Metallica were now a slower band as compared to the ferocious, thrashy band they were in the 80s. The late 90s was a weird time for Metallica. On the one hand, the band was still selling out arenas and stadiums around the world. On the other, their musical style seemed to be at odds with both their fans and the rising scene of nu metal. That's NU metal, nu metal. A metal movement that mixed hip-hop elements, down-tuned guitars, no guitar solos, and simpler structures into a brand new genre. Bands like Korn and Limp Bizkit were the new kids on the block, and they were making a real impact on the mainstream. In 1998, Korn released their breakthrough album Follow the Leader, which put nu metal on the map. Korn had created a new genre that made metal mainstream again, and many younger bands exploded into the scene because of it. Metallica didn't exactly fit the nu metal criteria. The guys had no hip-hop elements. They still played solos, and even though their songs are simpler, the boys making up Metallica are older than the new scene they found themselves in. That's not to say the band got any less popular. On the contrary, the band released the covers album Garage Inc. in 1998 to critical acclaim. Their image even moved beyond the makeup phase of the Lodes to a grittier metal look. Still no long hair, though. But it was better. Metallica were still playing big shows, winning awards, and partying really hard. They were looked at as rock royalty, as opposed to the pioneers they once were. Metallica were rock stars. They were living the rock star lifestyle. Alcohol abuse, partying, and growing egos ruled this time. Metallica were no longer the angry band that wrote ferocious riffs and spoke to an angry generation of kids. They were just another celebrity-filled band that made headlines and occasionally did cool shit. They needed something different. They needed to feel creative again. So, it's 1999. A few years had passed since Metallica put out any new music. They wanted to do something new, something bold. Something that would put them back into that pioneering chair. Luckily, opportunity came a-knockin'. Orchestra conductor Michael Kamen had approached Metallica with a crazy idea of doing a project together. An orchestra and Metallica. The boys were interested. Michael Kamen got some time to call the guys, and it was time to pitch.
Hello, Michael. Peter Mensch here, Metallica's manager.
Hello.
I got the boys with me on speakerphone. You can go ahead and do your pitch.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Hi, boys. Honored to be talking to you guys. Listen, my idea is that we select a bunch of Metallica classics, and I would fully write an original orchestra piece to be played along with it. This would reinterpret your songs entirely. We would do this live in front of a packed audience. Metallica playing a full set with the San Francisco Orchestra Symphony. What do you think?
The boys love it. This is exactly what they wanted. This sounded fresh. Their songs reinterpreted with an orchestra? This feels like the exact type of pioneering they can get behind. And with that, preparations began for Metallica's upcoming one-off show, S&M, or Symphony and Metallica. Orchestra conductor Michael Kamen worked on the composition and presented the band with his new vision. It was mind-blowing to the guys. James Hetfield would listen to the grand sound of the orchestra and just say, "Whoa, this is amazing." The guys were really excited. They even brought out two new songs especially for this event, No Leaf Clover and Minus Human. Both songs were written prior to the S&M period, but never released. Metallica felt this was the perfect time to bring these songs to light. As preparations were made and the stage was built, James would look at it all and couldn't believe that they were about to do this. He knew in his heart Cliff Burton, their fallen brother, who was a classical fan himself, would have loved this. He would have totally rooted for this. And even though there were many skeptics, James Hetfield thought, "If it fails, all we can say is that we tried. But if it's great, it'll be even sweeter." And so, on April 21st to April 22nd, 1999, Metallica performed a thunderous and powerful performance with the San Francisco Orchestra Symphony. Renditions of Nothing Else Matters, Outlaw Torn, and The Thing That Should Not Be took fans by storm. It was mesmerizing. S&M would be released on CD and DVD soon after, and would go on to sell over 8 million units globally and would be viewed as a milestone in Metallica's career. Maybe not the metal comeback that people were hoping for, but the boys felt good. Riding off the high of S&M and going into a new year, Metallica receives a call in early 2000. It was another exciting project. Whoa! Two exciting projects back to back? That's great! It was actor Tom Cruise and the production company behind the movie Mission Impossible 2. They wanted Metallica to write a brand new song for the movie soundtrack. Hell yeah! Lars Ulrich loves movies and this was really cool. It would put Metallica smack in the middle of the spotlight. Writing a song for the summer's biggest movie was no joke. Little did they know, this song would be the reason for a defining moment in Metallica's story, but not for the reasons they had hoped for. In early 2000, as the guys were completing work on the song, now titled I Disappear, they got a call from their management.
"Hi guys, it's Peter here. Am I on speakerphone?"
"Yeah, it's me, James. I got Lars, Kirk, and Jason here with me. What's up? We're working on the track."
"Well, it's about the track, actually. You see, it's already leaked, and it's been playing across radio stations worldwide."
What? How could that be? I mean, it's not even fully mastered yet. We're working on it right now."
"Sorry to tell you this, guys. I don't want to be the bearer of bad news. We conducted an investigation, and we traced the source to a website called Napster. It's this new website which allows people to upload MP3 songs and share it with their peers. It's called a peer-to-peer service. Someone uploaded the song to Napster."
"Peter, what the f*** do you mean? How many of our songs are on this Napster thing?"
You're not gonna like this, guys. All of them."
"All? All of our songs and albums are found for free on Napster? Is this even legal?"
Peter, Lars here. So people can just not buy our music anymore and just, go to the website and download our songs for free? We have no control over this?"
"That's right, Lars. We're looking into it."
This pissed off the boys so much. They hated that all the hard work they were putting into building Metallica had been taken away from them. They hated that they had absolutely no control how to release their songs. They hated that people were getting their songs for free. As they saw it, this was theft and it was going to destroy Metallica. And not only that, it was going to tank the entire music industry. This was an emergency. And so, in July of that year, Metallica officially sued Napster. Lars Ulrich led the battle and became the face of the lawsuit against Napster. At first, many bands encouraged Metallica to go forward with the lawsuit, as they recognized the damage that Napster and P2P services will have on the industry. But once Metallica v. Napster case became the biggest topic in entertainment news, Metallica's friends started to back out of their support. Everyone noticed how popular Napster was around the world, and Metallica were viewed as the greedy corporation that was coming to crush something the kids loved. Fans walked out on the band, destroyed their CDs, and boycotted their music. The environment was toxic. No band wanted that to be associated with their image, especially the younger bands in the new metal scene. In fact, the biggest band in the world at the time, rap rockers Limp Bizkit, took a stand with Napster. Limp Bizkit teamed up with Napster to organize a free tour across the US. Band frontman Fred Durst said that he wasn't worried about Napster, and that it was a great tool for people to discover new music. The people who are worried about Napster, he said, are those worried about their bank accounts, putting him at odds with Metallica. So there you have it. The cool young bands like Limp Bizkit were siding with the cool new technology companies like Napster, and Metallica were viewed as the older, greedy generation trying to end something really cool. Metallica's image was tarnished. At an appearance at the MTV Music Awards, Metallica were booed on stage. Ultimately, Metallica won the lawsuit, and Napster would file for bankruptcy due to the gruesome case, and it would be destroyed forever. At that point, Metallica's image needed repair, but so did the relationships that existed within the group. You see, Metallica had become so disjointed from one another. They all lived extremely different lifestyles. James Hetfield, for example, loved hunting and he drank a whole lot. Lars Ulrich was living up the celebrity lifestyle and he was so into art collecting. Jason Newsted, the kid who was once really excited to be part of this group, was working on his own music and was really frustrated with the direction the band was taking. Nothing would highlight this fractious nature more than an interview in Playboy magazine the band had conducted that year. The band was taking a short hiatus at the time and were interviewed separately from one another. The interview would highlight just how much Metallica, as a unit, was disjointed and somewhat resented one another. During that interview, the world would see just how unhappy the group was. Jason Newsted, Metallica's bassist, would reveal just how much he hated James Hetfield's attitude towards anyone doing any music outside of Metallica. He would not allow Jason to pursue any musical projects outside of the band. For Jason, that was a hard one to swallow, because that's all Jason knew. And when the band took months off to spend time with families, Jason, the only one without a family, would have nothing to do. James always demanded loyalty and unity, and he feared that if Jason stepped out of the bounds of Metallica, it would destroy them as a unit. During that interview, the love-hate relationship between Lars Ulrich and James Hetfield would be front and center. Quotes about them not calling each other days at a time, or how Lars can get pretty snotty and mouthy during interviews, are just a few examples to go by. Suffice it to say, Metallica's dirty laundry was out there for the world to see. Q Prime management felt they had to step in order to save the band from breaking up. The situation was so bad that in late 2000, the management team brought in a counselor by the name of Phil Towell. Phil was known to help NFL teams get along better and encourage more cohesion within these units. The band, well, they reluctantly agreed to sit with Phil, but after one session, the band felt uncomfortable to move forward, namely Jason Newsted. In January 2001, Jason calls for a meeting with his band members. Entering the studio, Jason starts.
I think it's best for us to take a year off. Just cool it. We need to get our shit together, guys. I mean, we've been going nonstop for all this time. 14 years. We're also going through so much. I mean, divorces, families, even back injuries. I mean, I got one. We need to have some time out. And guys, I would like to use this time to focus on working on my side project, EchoBrain. Jason looks at the room, but there's silence. He knows James Hetfield's stance on this topic. His idea was not entertained. It was flat out rejected. James looks at him and says, "Jason, we're not taking a year off. Forget about that. And you can sure as hell forget about releasing any music with EchoBrain." That was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. After all the hazing he's received from the band and all the stuff that he had to put up with, Jason felt that this was it. This was the ultimate form of disrespect. A few days later, he officially quit Metallica. 15 years of blood, sweat, and tears, Jason Newsted was a relentless force in the band. The disrespect he felt compounded with the injuries he's caused himself for playing live all these years pushed him over the edge. The news sent shockwaves across the industry. You gotta understand, to the new generation of Metallica fans, the younger fans who got into the band during this era, the Load era, so to speak, Jason was the bass player. They never knew Cliff, so they grew up on Jason's bass pounding and ferocious live energy. It was a blow for the band and for the fans alike. This prompted Metallica to be more introspective. What had happened? The remaining members of Metallica recognized, how did things get to this point? Here they are, a trio once again, after 15 years. The remaining members of Metallica recognized that it was in the best interest of the group to start working really hard on their relationship as band members. So they brought back Phil Towle to help them sort out this mess. They had to know what went wrong. But in many ways, the band were still not ready for that. Because on July 19, 2001, and after years of alcohol abuse and addiction, James Hetfield checked himself into a rehab facility to undergo treatment for alcoholism and other addictions. You see, James always struggled with alcohol. In the early years, the band would be known to their fans as Alcoholica due to the excess partying and excess drinking. And James, he would fall into the traps of addiction throughout his career. Two members, only months apart, were no longer active members of Metallica. The band had officially reached rock bottom. With Jason Newsted leaving and James Hetfield in rehab with no end in sight, the band's future was uncertain. Lars Ulrich, the man who originally placed that ad in the paper 20 years ago, for the first time had no idea what to do and how to move the band forward. It was all crumbling, everything they worked for. So with no word from Hetfield, Lars and Kirk started weighing their options. There was a real possibility that Metallica was over. So what's next? We'll talk about that next time on Legendary Rock Stories. See you then.